KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. American life today is governed by irrational fear, and it's controlling our thoughts and our judgments. That's according to author Sasha Abramski. The Sacramento-based Nation magazine journalist will join us to talk about his new book, Jumping at Shadows. It's an investigation into the psychology of culture dominated by fear and anxiety. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Jumping at Shadows is Sacramento-based journalist Sasha Abramski's polemic against what he calls America's most dangerous epidemic, irrational fear. The new book portrays a political and cultural landscape that is increasingly defined by our worst fears and anxieties. This fearful outlook, he writes, affects our decisions on everything from where we vacation to healthcare to parenting. And Abramski is, I should mention, contributing writer for The Nation and has written several books, including The American Way of Poverty. He joins us this hour here in studio to discuss his book and political implications of fear. And welcome, Sasha Abramski.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
I should say welcome back. It's been many years since you were here last, but good to have you back. Let's go back to the beginning of your book. It all begins in Valparaiso in Chile, and you thought you were having a heart attack. It turns out you had some neurotoxins and sushi, but it kind of taught you a big life lesson and a political lesson as well.
Yeah, so I had actually just gotten this book contract to write this book about fear, and I'd put it off to one side, and my family and I had had this long-standing plan. We were going to go down to Chile and spend a couple months learning Spanish. So we took the kids out of school, we arranged independent study, and we began this sort of really lovely adventure in Chile. And the only downside was, partway through the trip, I became extremely ill. And my heart and blood pressure started doing all kinds of crazy things. My energy level tanked. And I started going in and out of hospital. And if I was sensible, I would have just packed up and gone back to California. But I was a bit stubborn. So I thought, I'm going to tough this one out.
Was your Spanish pretty good by this
point? My Spanish is horrible. Oh. And I'm a terrible linguist. So I'm going in and out of hospital. I'm trying to explain that I'm having these heart palpitations, et cetera, et cetera. And they couldn't work out what was wrong. So they'd sort of give me anti-inflammatories, they'd give me various other stuff, and they'd send me on my way. And I came back to California. And at that point, I found out that my cousin in Los Angeles had started experiencing the exact same set of symptoms at the exact same set of times. And the only overlap was just before I'd gone down to Chile, I'd gone to Los Angeles to say goodbye to her, and we'd had a sushi meal together. So I phoned a friend, a cousin of mine in Virginia. He's an infectious disease specialist. He starts doing the literature. And eventually he says, look, you can have all these tests. And I was having echocardiograms. I was having CAT scans. I was having MRIs. I was having every test invented. They weren't finding stuff. He said, look, you can have all these tests, but I suspect you've got a fish-based neurotoxin and that you and your cousin are just going to have to sweat this one out. And so we did. It took about a year and a half. We both felt like hell for that year and a half. And eventually we started to recover. But it made me think, when you have this sort of undiagnosed illness and it makes you very scared and it makes you very nervous, it in some ways, individually, is like what happens when a society gets absolutely obsessed with fear, with paranoias, with anxieties about different bad things that could or will happen. And so that's the opening of the book, what happens when we think we might be under neurotoxin attack.
And it takes us into the whole nature of threat assessment with respect to things like terrorism as opposed to everyday violence, or people who are afraid to get on a plane as opposed to going in a car where they know they could have much more likelihood of violence, and all of those kinds of things that maybe come under the category. You even mentioned Ebola. People are afraid of Ebola as opposed to the flu, which is much more disastrous and much more likely to get. But, of course, a lot of these fears are real fears. They're kind of what I call the fears of the lottery. You know, yeah. It could happen to us at any time. And so we balloon those fears. But what you point out, and what I think is significant for people to take in the whole calculus of this, is the role of the media, the role of political campaigns in terms of exacerbating these fears.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I found extraordinary when I was researching the book, I had this wonderful opportunity to talk to leading psychologists, neuroscientists. And I'm somebody who's written about politics and written on social justice themes for 25 years. So for me, this was an adventure into the unknown. And it gave me this opportunity to talk to people about how the brain works and about how we acquire fears, how our emotions play out, how they play out chemically, how they play out biologically. And one of the things that's really interesting is that fear is a very sticky emotion. And we had to evolve that way. We had to sort of err on the side of caution that we're very good at filing patterns that represent risk to us. And once we have that in our brain, it stays there. So if we see a similar pattern in the future, it triggers a sense of anxiety, a sense of risk, a sense of danger. But the thing about the media
is... It stays there. It balloons.
It gets bigger and bigger the more we're exposed to it. So the thing about the media is it turns out that we acquire fear in multiple ways. So on the most basic level, the level we evolved to deal with fear, we encounter it by direct experience. So if we're a caveman 30,000 years ago and a saber-toothed tiger is in front of us, growling at us, roaring at us, whatever saber-toothed tigers do, we're very good at recognizing that that's a dangerous moment and we better do something. We better prepare to run or prepare to fight or do something to protect ourselves. But in the modern world, one of the ways we acquire fear is actually through secondary exposure, through media images. So it turns out that our brains are almost as good at filing away that image of danger if we see it secondarily, if we see it on Facebook or on local television news or in a newspaper headline. And when we see it that way, we're not necessarily very good at calculating probability. So we see a lot of headlines about Ebola would be a good case in point. And it overwhelms our senses. We think threat, 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 threat. And we start changing our behavior. We maybe modify where we travel. We modify how we interact with other people in public settings. And the problem is, it's getting the headlines not because it's the norm, but because it's the exception. That's what gets headlines, the exception. So if two or three people in the United States are exposed to Ebola, every newspaper in the country, every news outlet in the country, every social media outlet is covering that story.
Well, meanwhile, if it bleeds, it leads, right?
Well, if it bleeds, it leads selectively. Because the other thing is, while those two or three people are getting Ebola, you might have 10,000 or 100,000 or a million people coming down with the flu, and a percentage of those will end up hospitalized, and a percentage of those will end up dying. So because the flu is just sort of background, it's mundane, it's ordinary, it doesn't get the headlines, even though the risk is actually far greater.
I think you put it, fear sells. I mean, it's almost that simple in many ways.
Absolutely. So in the 1990s, it was, if it bleeds, it leads. Every journalist going into journalism 25, 30 years ago knew that adage. So what I say now is, if it scares, it blares. So if it's really scary, we're going to saturate the media with it. We're going to give you all kinds of color-coded alerts. We're going to get you as scared as possible because we know that fear sells.
Now, this is leading us to the notion of a kind of cultural anxiety or collective anxiety disorder, which is, again, an interesting way that you put it. And FDR put it simply, you know, the only thing to fear is fear itself, but maybe the only thing irrationally to fear is irrational fear or something along those lines. We've got this whole culture that seems now hemmed in by excessive fear. And when you get into the political realm, I mean, you know, the neuroscience stuff is fascinating. I hope we can go into that in some detail here, all the neural sides of this and the amygdala and all that. But the political side is something that I think people need to be aware of. I mean, we get afraid of immigrants. We get afraid of the inner city. People of color. I mean, there are real fears that can be attached to these just by reading, you know, statistics and reading what happens in the daily storm of things. But also hidden germs and pedophilia, you know, reading about Judge Moore now, and suddenly this becomes blared, and it becomes blared to an irrational degree.
Yeah, I think what happens is that once we start forming communities around fear, once we start saying, all right, I'm scared of this, my neighbor's scared of this, my colleagues are scared of this, once we start forming these sort of social bonds with fear as the solvent, it's very easy to manipulate that kind of community. A fear-driven community is one that's very exploitable by demagogic political leadership. So, you know, I actually started writing this book tail end of 2014, so quite a long way before Trump declared his candidacy. But it seemed to me there were these trends in society that were lending themselves to a very dangerous kind of politics if you had people willing to exploit irrational fears and willing to stoke those fears. And so Trump comes along. I was about halfway through the book at the time, and I began doing a ton of reporting around Trump. And I was paying particular attention to the way that he was using language to stoke fear. And you mentioned immigration. So, you know, he launches his candidacy by coming down from Trump Tower and exiting the elevator with all this pomp and circumstance and making this crazy statement about Mexican immigrants being rapists and criminals. And he goes from there to talking about banning all Muslims as a way to counter terrorism. And he goes from there to saying, I'll torture terrorism suspects. I'll collectively punish terrorism suspects and their families. I'll urge the police to be rougher on criminals. And basically what he was doing, he wasn't really proposing complicated, nuanced, sensible public policy. He had no interest in that. What he was doing was identifying communities of fear, whether it was fear around terrorism, fear around disease, fear around immigration, fear around cultural change. And he was playing to those fears. Now, you said Roosevelt had this wonderful quote in 1933, the only thing to fear is fear itself. And for me, it's one of the most inspirational quotes in American political history, that if you can sort of sideline that fear, if you can reinstall optimism as a central trait, really good things can happen politically. But for Trump, optimism is poison. Because a man like Trump, a demagogue like Trump, can never in a million years get elected in a country as diverse and as complicated as is the United States of America in an optimistic moment. His only road to power is playing fear, milking fear for all it's worth.
But you know, it occurred to me that we have been a fear-ridden society a long time now, as evidenced by the fact that we keep accumulating more and more arms and guns. I mean, I think it plays into and certainly contributes to the number of people who own guns and possess guns.
Absolutely. And, you know, this notion of fear is certainly not something that came out of nowhere. You know, there was a wonderful book written a generation ago called The Culture of Fear. There was a book written two generations ago called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And you can certainly see these moments in American history where fear sort of acquires a disproportionate weight. I think one of the differences today is the warp speed that that fear can be transmitted because of social media. And social media is very, very good at certain things. It's very good, for example, in the middle of a natural disaster, if you want to marshal resources for food or for medical assistance. But one of the things that's really destructive about social media is it compresses space and time. So if you open your social media accounts and you see one story after another, let's say of terrorism attacks, and they might be 10,000 or 12,000 miles away, but that sense of distance gets compressed. And so what you basically experience is danger in your living room, or danger in your bedroom, or wherever it is that you open your smart account, your smartphone, your tablet, and read these stories. And so in the social media moment, fear gets magnified and it gets transmitted from one person to another almost virally.
It's like an epidemic sometimes.
It really is.
I mean, a serious infection. But wondering, let me do this, by the way. I know there are many people who have questions about what we're talking about. Fear as America's most dangerous epidemic is kind of the way Sasha Abramski talks about it in his book Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. Very provocative subtitle there, too. He also, we should mention, teaches writing at UC Davis and has written for many years for The Nation. Let me invite you to come in here with your own thoughts and your own questions or comments on this whole subject. I want to push back a little bit on Trump and get your thoughts about something else, which I've seen a lot on social media recently, but let me invite people to join us now. Let me invite you to join us by phone, first of all. The toll-free number to call is 866-733-6786, and you can be part of the program and part of the conversation. Again, toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, or join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I was just going to say that there are a lot of people who are getting outraged and alarmed about Trump to the extent that they're saying it's a banana republic, it's a dictatorship, he's got his hands on the nuclear button. All these things may be real fears, but everything we're talking about may be real fears too. So I'm wondering, you know, people are saying Trump is going to lead us into World War III, and they take that to be sort of gospel after a fashion because things move so rapidly. That may be a mistake too.
Yeah, I think one of the things that happens in a moment like this is fear transcends ideology. So you end up with people on the left, people on the right, people who don't even define themselves as being left or right, but they get very inundated by this sense that things are going off the rails and going off the rails quickly. And so you end up with a political rhetoric that's very hyperbolic. You end up with a political rhetoric that lends itself to conspiracy theory, that lends itself to a sort of very paranoid view of how the world functions. Now, that said, that doesn't mean that certain fears aren't more real or more important than other fears. And, you know, one of the things that fascinates me is how America historically has underplayed the very real threat of climate change over the last several decades. And so, you know, Trump at the moment is in this thing where we're in complete climate change denial. But even before that moment, you had large numbers of Americans completely unwilling to look at the threat, the existential threat posed by climate change. The other area which we've been notoriously bad at paying full attention to is nuclear weapons and nuclear proliferation. And you sort of had this thing after the end of the Cold War where it sort of went out of sight, out of mind. The nuclear weapons didn't disappear. In actual fact, more countries than ever now have those nuclear weapons. Now, by any reasonable measure, that is a threat that we should be paying a huge amount of attention to, of political attention, emotional attention, intellectual attention, and working out ways to neutralize it. But in actual fact, until recently, and I think it's probably different now because of the North Korea threat, but until recently, when there were rankings done, and there are a bunch of different surveys that are done of what Americans fear. And so you can get these lists of sort of 20 or 30 or 40 things that Americans fear. And some of these lists had more Americans fearing spiders than fearing nuclear weapons, and more Americans fearing not guns, but gun control than nuclear weapons.
No, the spider thing makes me think of what you write about, you know, terror, thanks to Steven Spielberg, the terror of sharks, you know, when you're going for a swim and everything, even though you have to look at probability. You have to look at risk just in terms of the numbers or the likelihood and all the rest of that. But, you know, you write about like the sniper in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I happened to be around Baltimore when and people were terrified. They didn't want to go to a gas station. They didn't want to go anywhere, you know, because this guy was just hitting people randomly with gunfire and death. But there's all that sense of, you know, it's like kids being overprotective of kids. And you write about, you know, this Montessori school, which is really to an extreme in terms of all the security by any standards. And yet at the same time, parents are afraid of their children and people are afraid in Washington because I could be the one hit by the stray bullet.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing that fascinated me about the Washington, D.C., the sniper attacks, they came at the end of this ghastly year. It was a few months after the 9/11 attacks and the entire world was on edge. And America was, you know, not surprisingly, in a terrible, terrible state because we'd suffered the worst attack in American history. And I lived in New York on 9/11. I remember how absolutely bewilderingly terrifying that day was. But one of the things that happened was we went into this sort of lockdown mode psychologically. And I spoke to a neuroscientist called Damian Stanley, a guy at Caltech, about this. And he specialized in working out how the brain computes probability, estimates risk. And he said, look, what happens when there's an extraordinary event like 9/11 is the brain doesn't have anything to compare it to. And so as a survival mechanism, it goes into the most conservative, cautious lockdown mode possible. And that's sort of necessary evolutionary. If you're confronted with something absolutely unexplainable, you have to be as cautious and conservative as possible until you can sort of navigate that environment a bit. So what happened in Baltimore and Washington occurred in the wake of that. And it created this absolute panic in that region. And I think part of it was, as you said, the sheer randomness of it. It didn't actually kill that many people, but the randomness of it meant that people felt they had absolutely no agency, that they were just sort of prey. They were subject to this, you know, terrible predatory event that was occurring. And I think it's that lack of agency that's particularly important. So when people feel that things are changing very fast and changing in a way that they have no control over, that's when they get really scared. And that could be everything from
that could be the
attacks.
Human condition too.
Exactly. That's it. It could be, especially in the globalized, fast-paced technological world that we're in, it's the human condition. On a daily basis, new technologies are introduced. On a daily basis, our culture shifts. On a near daily basis, our morals shift. You know, what we regard as socially acceptable or socially unacceptable, family structure changes. And these things happen faster today than they've ever happened before. And some of that's good. It makes us a very dynamic species. But the downside is, it makes a lot of people really, really, really nervous.
If you've just joined us, we're talking to Sasha Abramsky, who has his hand on the pulse of our nervousness here in his new book called Jumping at Shadows. Let me get a caller in here, and let me go to you, Allison. Allison, welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I'm enjoying, this is a really important discussion. I just wanted to amplify a little bit the impact of 9/11 that it had on our country. And in particular, the response to 9/11, for every terrible event, there can be a response of trying to move cautiously and solve problems, or there can be a response which is built on fear. And I think we, as a country, and perhaps our leadership as well, took the course of responding based on fear, and that has led to a lot of aggression the consequences thereof that we're experiencing even as reaching into today.
Yeah, it's an important point, Allison. I thank you for it. In fact, I had the occasion of interview by Skype recently Edward Snowden here at the Current Theater, and we were talking about surveillance. You were talking about color coding. I mean, Americans were on high anxiety after 9/11, understandably so, I think. But then all of that spreading the net, trying to do full surveillance of all Americans with the result possibly of catching the terrorists who may be there. It was an extreme response by many people's lights, but by other people's lights, there were all those lights going off saying danger, danger, danger. Yeah. It was the appropriate response.
Well, I mean, I remember in those months after 9/11, so you had the sniper attack in D.C., and then you also had the anthrax attacks around the country where these letters were mailed somewhat randomly, and the cumulative effect was something approaching a national panic at that point. And you saw very, very quickly this sort of frenzy of fear. And part of it was a rational response to these series of appalling events. And part
of it. You
see
it now with mass shootings again, don't you?
Well, to a lesser extent, because one of the things that happened after 9/11 was that you had these color-coded alerts that actually told you absolutely nothing. So it wasn't a specific threat. It wasn't that you'd put on CNN or Fox News or any other news network and be told, all right, you must avoid this area because we have a credible threat for this area. Instead, we'd get these very, very generalized national color-coded alerts, yellow to orange to red, and they change very, very quickly. And the effect was not to make us feel more empowered. The effect was the exact opposite. It made us feel absolutely at the mercy of forces we had no control over. And one of the problems was that these color-coded alerts were clearly being used for political purpose. So if the Bush administration was having a really problematic week on something non-related to terrorism, maybe they had bad unemployment data or something like that, suddenly you'd have a very non-specific terrorism threat and the alert would go up. And it may or may not have been a coincidence. But the effect was this permanent state of anxiety. And when Allison's talking about, you know, what happens when that kind of fear is the response, well, a couple things happen. And you talked about Edward Snowden. The most obvious thing is that we start trading in liberties for security. So we start saying, all right, we'll let you, you know, listen in on our phone conversations or photograph our mail or whatever it is, if it makes us a little bit safer. But the second thing that happens is we start regarding certain groups as so risk-worthy, so fear-worthy, that they don't qualify for basic human rights.
Again, we're talking to Sasha Bromski. Coming up at a break, we will take more of your phone calls and have you more involved in the conversation here. Remember, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum at kqed.org. What are you afraid of? We'll find out how the American dream fits in this and also talk with Sasha Bromski about a provocative article that he published recently in the Sacramento Bee. We do want you to be involved, though, so feel free to join us. You can tweet us as well. Our Twitter handle's at KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Sasha Bromski. He's the author of Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. I should mention the book is dedicated to someone we both admire, Eduardo Galeano. And what about the subtitle of your book, though, The End of the American Dream?
You know, the subtitle is shorter than it ideally should be because there's only so much room on a page. So the subtitle is basically saying that when fear triumphs, when fear becomes the dominating sort of currency of our politics, it's very hard for something like the American dream to thrive, because the American dream, for what it's worth, and, you know, it's always been a controversial topic, but if there is an American dream, it's about optimism, it's about the future looking better than the past, it's about people coming here to make it, it's about equal opportunity and so on and so forth. When we start dividing us against them, when we start looking at other people and viewing them as threats, when we start building walls, real and psychological, against the rest of the world, it's very hard for the American dream as we recognize it to flourish. The reason I said that the subtitle is too short is I actually don't think in the long run you can organize societies around fear and hatred. I don't believe that. I think you can do it in the short term and you can cause tremendous damage while you're doing it. And we've seen that from other episodes in history, that when people become consumed by fear, they tolerate atrocities in the name of security. And they've done that in many different countries at many different moments in the past. But I do think that these are firestorms and that they burn themselves out, because as a way of living, as a way of forming community, it's intensely destructive. It's intensely destructive to the human spirit, to the community spirit. And so the longer subtitle would be The Triumph of Fear and the Temporary End of the American Dream, until we come back to our senses and realize this isn't a good way to live.
All right, we'll come back to our callers, and let me go next to a caller in Orinda. Dan, you're on. Morning.
Hello. So from a rational point of view, climate change with a very high probability is going to cause catastrophic impacts to ourselves and our children on the path we're on. And as you discussed earlier, we have an irrational lack of fear of climate change. How do we use fear, or how do we get people to properly fear climate change? What would be your suggestions?
That's a great question, Dan. And I think one of the reasons that we don't pay as much attention to it as we should is it's too big. And so we displace our fears onto things that are smaller, more manageable, that we can tell stories about. And I'm a big believer in storytelling. You can give people data, but most people don't process hard data very, very well. They might have some sense of what the data is telling them. But
or they can look at the destruction from a hurricane and not necessarily make the link or connect the dots.
That's right. So they see these big events and they don't necessarily make the connections. And I think it's the job of people who actually are thinking about climate change, whether it's scientists, whether it's community organizers, whether it's urban planners. It's the job of those people to tell stories that are going to connect with an audience. So humanize the impact. Talk about climate refugees. Talk about what happens when entire neighborhoods are flooded or destroyed by fires or destroyed by drought. Now, that's not going to change people's impressions overnight, because public opinion shifts usually fairly slowly on big events like this. But I think if you look at the rest of the world, there are many other parts of the world now where over the last 15 to 20 years, an understanding of the seriousness of climate change has taken root. And you see that in certainly in European countries. You also see it in many parts of Asia and Africa. We haven't seen it so far in the United States, at least in part because until recently it seemed somewhat abstract. So it's this big, big event and people throw big numbers about, but it's hard to see. But I think that's starting to change. If you look at what happened this hurricane season in Puerto Rico, in Florida, in Texas, if you look at the fires here in California, I think you're starting to see this critical mass of people aware that their livelihoods and their lifestyles and the well-being of their families and of their descendants are now at risk. And that provides an opportunity for a more sensible conversation. Doesn't mean it's going to happen quickly, certainly not with this administration in Washington, D.C. But I think there is room for a cultural shift around this. But we have to work out how to talk about it. We have to work out how to tell those stories.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. But speaking of critical mass, there was an editorial you did in the Sacramento Bee where you were essentially arguing that when it comes to violence, the kind of violence one sees from the right, and specifically, I think it was probably inspired by Charlottesville, that the best response is solidarity and mass opposition, but of a nonviolent variety. And, I mean, you argue it pretty strongly, and it goes against the idea, I suppose, that Antifa and organizations like that have, that violence has to be met with violence.
Yeah.
So what you're saying essentially could be true about fear as well. That is, the number of people that you can mobilize against an irrational fear and have enlightened about the irrationality of it, the more you're going to do in conquering it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I've written in a few different venues for The Nation, the Sacramento Bee, and elsewhere about nonviolence, because I really do believe that. And I believe it for two reasons. I believe it both intellectually and morally. I just don't believe in violence as a political response. And also pragmatically, it seems to me an infinitely bad idea to meet the neo-Nazi and fascist thugs on the right with violence from the left. I don't think it wins hearts and minds, and I don't think that pragmatically it's a sensible way to go.
In fact, so, you say it could be pragmatically what happened during the Nixon administration.
Well, that's right. And, you know, Nixon was very good at marshalling what he called the silent majority, people who were deeply suspicious of dissent, deeply suspicious of protest, willing to give law and order institutions the benefit of the doubt time and time and time again. And Nixon understood that mentality, and he played to it, and he won election twice on it. And Trump, when he was running for election in 2016, again and again and again used that phrase, the silent majority. And so I think it plays into the hands of far-right politicians and far-right activists if violence is unleashed on the streets. So for the moral reasons, the philosophical reasons, and the pragmatic reasons, to me, violence just doesn't make sense as a mass movement in America. Now, the other thing, you talk about meeting fear with fear. I think the same way about that. I think that you can't create entire political movements on the left based around fear. It might be good for fundraising. And I was actually at a presentation yesterday, and a colleague of mine was explaining how he gets all these emails from progressive fundraisers, which are designed to sow fear and panic, and then they ask you for $5 or $10. So I don't think it's just the right that's doing this. But I do think that we have to find a more optimistic political voice. We have to find ways of talking about political solutions, what we're going to do as an alternative, whether it's healthcare access or whether it's changing as to how we fund higher education or whether it's environmental policy. But we have to find programmatic solutions that go way beyond just a language of fear.
Well, we do have a link to that op-ed I mentioned on our website, kqed.org/forum, and you can also post questions or comments on that website at kqed.org/forum. Talking to Sasha Abramski, his new book is Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. And what issue do you think gets maybe overblown by, or maybe not even maybe, by the media or by that matter politicians? You can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Here's a listener, Marte, who says, fear of job loss and homelessness is not imaginary.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, we should be paying attention to economic dislocation. And I've been writing about economic dislocation for more than 20 years. And I think that actually the politics of fear is one manifestation of deep economic anxiety. When people fear that their homes are at risk, when they fear their jobs are insecure, when they lose access to pensions or lose access to healthcare, and when they can't afford to send their kids to school or to a good college, at that point, fear becomes very, very pervasive, and it becomes very amorphous. And one of the dangers is that you then end up with demagogic politicians who say, well, you would still have a job and you would still have a home if it weren't for the immigrants, or if it weren't for, I don't know, women in the workplace or whatever it might be. And it's that demagogy that's given free rein unless we come up with sensible programmatic alternatives.
Let me read some comments. Idelm writes, the summary here is if you can scare people, even from non-existent phantom enemies, and act like you are the savior, then you can exploit them. Using fear against the American people makes stealing their assets and their civil liberties possible. Hunter writes, hysteria worship is definitely a reality in our society. Curating your daily social media and news websites is a necessity. Listener asks, could you please talk about the effect of becoming numb to all the bad and fearful news?
Yes, I could. I teach journalism at UC Davis, and one of the things that I do is I tell them, look, you're going to have current affairs tests. And I do it not to embarrass my students, but because I think it's genuinely important, both as journalism students and also as people preparing to enter society as functioning adult members of a community, to be aware of current events. And I'm amazed at the numbers of students who aren't reading the newspapers and they're not following current affairs. And it's not because they're bad students. They're incredibly intelligent human beings. But I think in part it's because the news is so bad. And so if you're daily deluged with bad news, one of the options that you have as an individual is to tune out. You just stop paying attention. You stop following the news. But the danger of that is the news still goes on. So whether you're following it or not, the environment is still being damaged. Whether you're following it or not, regulations in the workplace are being weakened. Financial institution regulations are being weakened. Vast amounts of money are being diverted to very wealthy people through tax cuts that are designed to favor the rich. So the problem with not paying attention is the world doesn't stop. It goes on, and all that happens is you've just disempowered yourself. So I think it's a really dangerous response to what's happening.
Let me read some more responses. This is a listener who writes, I didn't buy into Donald Trump's fear-mongering. Still, it had a profound effect on me. Found myself in a constant state of fear and anxiety during the first few weeks of his presidency. I would wake up in the morning to see if we had bombed anyone. His reckless rhetoric about war against other countries troubled me so much that I was having nightmares. I'm only now beginning to feel a sense of normalcy, whatever that means, in the Trump era. Of course, there's also a question about numbness. There's a question about normalizing here, too. I mean, in the minds, fear can become the normal state because it would appear that that's something to be normally responding to. In fact, I have another listener who says, fear is natural, useful, and has its place in the human experience of decision-making. It's only an issue when not tempered with logic and conscious response. Ron writes, I think Snowden created a whole new kind of inflated fear. What examples of injury or damage exist? That's a whole subject for another program. Here is Charles, who says, a favorite quote that seems sadly all too relevant today, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. That's from Voltaire. And David wants to know, how is the author's book any different than Barry Glassner's excellent book, The Culture of Fear?
Yeah. Well, to answer the last one, The Culture of Fear was written a generation ago. And obviously, some of what I'm writing about, Glassner was writing about a generation ago. What I say in my book is that Glassner was writing at the beginning of a process, and I'm writing during the maturation of that process. So these trends that were being identified a generation ago, fear of crime, fear of drugs, fear of the welfare cheat, and so on and so forth, have metastasized, and they've reached a point now where whether we're talking about parenting or whether we're talking about schooling or whether we're talking about disease response or whether we're talking about overseas military interventions and national security policy, that we've reached this tipping point where a vast number of our most important political decisions are being made through a lens of grossly inflated fear. And so, you know, it seems to me that history sort of has chapters. And if Glassner was writing at the start of a chapter, here we are in 2016, 2017, going into the midterms next year in 2018, and we're at the end of this chapter. And we've now seen what happens when fear runs rampant. And one of the things that happens is politically implausible candidates suddenly become plausible. So someone like Donald Trump, who wouldn't in a million years have been electable at most moments in American history, suddenly becomes a credible presidential candidate. And the actions of a man like Trump, as you just said, Michael, become normalized. That things that would have been so far outside the bounds of the political acceptable, whether it's the increasing usage of a language supporting torture, or whether it's the almost flippant threats about nuclear war with North Korea, these things become normalized in an extraordinary moment. And to me, it's fascinating and it's horrifying in about equal measure.
You also write about really the physiological as well as the psychological dimensions of the stress hormones altering neural patterns in our brain and affecting our thoughts and actions, but also when you have political candidates who are in there scaring and appealing to demagoguery in one form or another to tamp down our supposed fears, it has, you talk about actually self-medicating, a similar process to self-medicating. Quote a Tel Aviv University psychologist who talks about the charisma effect. Let's talk about that because I think it's really kind of fascinating. This thing called neurocoupling. It's kind of like dancing.
Yeah, it was this wonderful image that he presented, which is that there's now this neuroscience where you can see in response to charisma the release of these chemicals that are designed evolutionarily to develop bonds of trust between mother and child. It's oxytocin. And it's a very important chemical because without it, the bond of trust between the mother and the baby is weakened. But in the presence of charismatic politicians, you start seeing a similar effect. You start seeing these chemical changes in the brains of the audience, and you start seeing again what he called neurocoupling, this idea that brains start syncing, that you start having a very predictable response across hundreds or thousands of separate individual brains. Now, anyone who's ever seen propaganda footage of the Nuremberg rallies in Germany will immediately understand that image, that in the presence of the charisma, the demonic charisma of Hitler, thousands of people sort of entered this near delirium, this state of utter irrationality. And you also saw it in Trump's rallies, certainly in the election campaign, but even today you see it when he goes to rally his party base. You see these huge rallies with these extraordinarily enthused members, and they start responding as one in response to the most outrageous comments he makes. So when he starts saying, well, wouldn't it be good if we could beat up protesters, you see this sort of instant crowd reaction. When he starts saying, wouldn't it be good if we could shoot terrorism suspects using bullets dipped in pig's blood, which he said at several rallies in 2016, you saw the same thing, that the more outrageous the comment, the more the audience responded as one. And that's sort of the quintessential definition of successful demagogy.
Here's a listener, and you were talking about the importance with your students of telling them they should not remove themselves from the news. They have to keep up with the news and be current and everything. It's an important message I always try to communicate as a teacher, too. But here's Ford, who writes condemns us. He says, don't leave political parties and NGOs out of the list of fearmongers. They incessantly promote panic as part of their fundraising communications, and NPR, too. The wall-to-wall covering of a shooting for days, or the national broadcasting of items that are essentially local news. Why does NPR start my day in California with news of a family dying in a fire in North Carolina? It's poisonous. The media is giving us all PTSD. The world is a lovely place if you just turn it all off.
Well, you know, he's not entirely wrong. It's certainly true that fear is used as a fundraiser, and it's being used as a fundraiser by political parties across the spectrum and NGOs and other groups across the spectrum. That's true. The reason the media leads with these stories is because the way the media architecture has evolved over hundreds of years is that the exception is the headline. So if something happens every day, it fades into the background. It's definitionally not news. What becomes news is the anomaly. And that anomaly might be a terrorist attack. It might be a plane crash. It might be a particularly destructive fire.
Those anomalies are big news, though. I mean,
exactly. And so, you know, if you're an editor, and I'm not saying if I were an editor, I would do any different. If you're an editor and you're sitting with your colleagues and you're trying to work out what do you headline that day, you're going to headline the exceptional story, not the normal story. And if the exceptional story that day is a bomb going off in Paris or, you know, a mass shooting in Las Vegas, you're going to lead with that story because a lot of people are impacted and a lot of people are going to want to get instant news. The problem with our moment is that we lose the sense of context because we have so much news. It's not that, you know, we tune in once a day and listen to the evening news and then get on with our lives. That model has broken down. Now we all have smartphones and most of us have a news app on the smartphone and we get these breaking news alerts. And the breaking news can be anything, but usually it's a story about something bad because they know that's going to get an audience. And so 24/7, as long as you're awake, as long as you're somewhere near a smartphone or a tablet or a laptop or in a public space with cable TV news on, you're going to be subjected to bad news stories. And your listener's absolutely right that one of the impacts of that is we all start feeling in a state of permanent stress, whether it's PTSD or something else. But we all as a society get particularly stressed in a way that I don't think a generation or two or three ago we did because we didn't have access to the news 24/7. So it's not that our world is necessarily more dangerous. It's that we're able to see and to hear and to read about that world without any breaks in between.
Well, Tim asks a question that's apropos here, but first let me read a comment from Sharon who says, genetic engineering, especially when it comes to improving food crops, they are tested and they are safe. This is what she thinks has been overblown. I mean, the whole GMO issue and so forth. Tim says, yes, fear issue is a big problem. So how do we make progress to fix this situation?
Well, I think a few things. I think one of them is that we talk to people and that we get out of our comfort zone and that we're willing to have conversations across political and cultural and religious and racial divides. And that sort of sounds a bit kumbaya-ish, but it's not a bad idea. It's not a bad idea to get out of one's comfort zone and try and see the world through other people's eyes. But, you know, the second thing, and people ask me this every time I'm in a public conversation. They say, you know, how do we slow down a bit? And it made me start thinking about the slow food movement. And what I mean by that is if you go back 40 or 50 years and fast food was a novelty and it was kind of cool, everybody wanted it. Didn't matter their economic status, their social status. It was easy. It was quick. You could get a hamburger. You could get chicken wings. TV dinners. Didn't have to spend time thinking about it, preparing it. So what happened was people would come home from work. They'd bring a bucket of food. They'd sit the kids down in front of the TV. People would gobble up their meal and 5 minutes later it was done. And what got lost in that was the whole culture of conversation of the dining room table and the joy of actually preparing a meal and then slowly eating that meal and talking over that meal. And the other thing that happened was we started to realize there were health consequences, and that fast food was fast and it was cheap, but it was also kind of junky and would do bad things to us. And so in reaction, we started seeing this slow food movement, this idea that even though we can eat fast, maybe it's not a good idea to always eat fast.
Slow food movement began in Italy, actually.
Yeah, and it was very important because Italy is probably the country which most on earth is identified with that big family meal. They have these huge lunches and then these huge dinners, and they talk. And so it was anathema to people in Italy to see that being disintegrated. And so now we have a lot of people who very consciously avoid fast food, if they can. And I think it's the same thing with the politics of fear and the absorption of fear. It's very easy to do it. It's very easy to take out your cell phone every spare minute you have and click, 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 bad news, bad news, bad news. It's very easy to get on the subway in New York and now there's wireless and you can do the same thing. You know, people used to read books. And I think it's not a bad idea to just disconnect every so often.
Well, you may have to decondition yourself or just, you know,
yeah.
I mean, people are in such a habit and they get an endorphin high sometimes.
That's right. And it's sort of addictive. But it doesn't mean it's a good idea to always be on the cell phone and always be looking for bad news.
Let's look for some more of our callers here, and we go to you next, Ted. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I've always been interested in how some fears integrated into us, and we just got to accept them. I just, you know, I think people know that between 30 and 40,000 Americans are killed every year in automobile accidents, but we get in our cars every day and drive off. In California here, I've grown up in California and a little isolated from it because of our freeways, and it make long-distance travel much safer. But I worked in the Midwest a while back, and I was just struck by every family had a brother, a sister, somebody close that had been killed in an automobile accident. Again, that's just integration that we do with some things that we just accept in our lives and other things that are so abstract, so or at least low chance of it happening. We really worry about.
Yeah, it's a good point and an important point, Ted. And I guess it's not only the abstracting nature of it, it's also people are too dependent on their cars, Sasha. Yeah,
I think one of the reasons we deliberately choose not to be afraid of cars is because we need cars so much. They're such a part of our daily lives. And so we make this sort of very fallacious assumption. If we need it, if it's a part of our daily life, it must therefore be safe.
It's not only safety, though. I mean, in terms of automobile accidents that Ted is raising here, it's also the danger to the atmosphere and the air we breathe. But we don't take that into account.
That's right. I mean, there's all kinds of negative consequences that come with that very simple choice of whether to drive or not to drive. But, you know, I was in New York last week, a couple of weeks ago, and there was a terrorist attack on the West Side Highway. A young man drove his truck into a group of pedestrians and bicyclists, and it was a horrible attack, really horrible, and 8 people were killed, and it deservedly got a lot of attention. It was
including our covering it, yeah.
Exactly, and it should have been covered. But I went back to my hotel afterwards, and I thought, you know, this is a horrible event, and it certainly made me feel jittery. But I wonder how many people are killed in a given year in non-terrorism-related car crashes in New York. And it's very easy to find out because the data is collected. And it turns out that on an average year in New York, about 230 people are killed by cars, either in cars or pedestrians run over by cars. And so, you know, it struck me as really interesting. The amount of coverage devoted to the terrorism attack that killed 8 people is far in excess of the amount of coverage cumulatively in a given year for the 220 people
killed. But let's pause there for a moment, because when you think about 220 people killed, it obviously is overwhelming compared to the number 6 in a terrorist attack. I think the difference is also psychologically, when people are behind the wheel, they feel they're in control. There's an illusion of being in control because you get hit by a car, you know, without even recognizing some drunk drivers in your lane or whatever. But there is that psychological state somehow that I'm in control.
Yeah, and there's a lot of psychological and sociological research on that, that people are less scared of things that they feel they have a modicum of control over. Now, sometimes that's rational, but sometimes it's not. With car driving, it's rational up to a point because it means that you can make a conscious decision not to drink drive. It means you can decide not to text while you're driving. You can repair your car on a regular basis so that, you know, the wheel doesn't fall off. You know, it makes some sense that that control gives you less risk. But on the other hand, you don't have control over what the person in the other car is doing. You don't have control over, you know, a whole bunch of other things. And so the risk still remains.
And here's Art. Art, join us. Welcome.
I'm just curious about the effect of, I guess, fear and race and, the concept that some communities have been living under threat since time at the beginning of the country, really. And how that plays into fairness, representation, engagement in communities of color that we want to bring in to, say, higher education, for example.
Okay, it's an important question, Art, and I'm glad you brought it up. We've got only about a minute and a half left here, so Sasha writes a good deal about this in his book. Sasha Abramsky?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, communities that have been marginalized and demonized for centuries in some cases, that comes with consequences. So one of the things that I write about in my book is something called implicit bias. And implicit bias is about how stereotypes can become so deep-rooted that you can be completely non-racist at a conscious level, but under the hood, unconsciously, you're still making decisions in a way that reflect racial biases.
And I'm afraid to ask you, because there's short time left here, but you talk about that test with white police officers?
That's right. There are a whole bunch of permutations on it, but how people respond differently to images of black men versus white men, white men carrying weapons versus black men carrying weapons, or just images of blackness and goodness versus whiteness and badness, and how fast you respond, and then how fast you respond when you reverse it. So it's black and bad and white and good. And it's fascinating because it turns out that we are so saturated by stereotypes that with the best will in the world, most Americans are still racially biased. It's horrifying.
It's sad note to end on, but that's the conclusion of this hour. Sasha Abramsky, thank you so much for being with us, spending this time with us.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Again, Sasha Abramsky's book is called Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue this discussion online simply by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And the op-ed that Sasha wrote that we mentioned is also on our website, kqed.org/forum. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock, we'll be with Chris Matthews. He's got a biography of Bobby Kennedy, and we'll talk about politics with him as well. Thank you for being a part of today's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.